Thanks. So one thing that was missing in the title, which maybe was obvious from some of the statements in the morning, this is all in the context of N equals 4 supergravity. And the other opening comment I want to make is that usually talks are designed to enlighten the audience or perhaps clarify some issues. This talk is different. It's intended to confuse you. And so I will have done my job if you walk out more confused than you came in. So... So let me actually start by introducing the various actors in our scenario. And so the first, of course, is the N equals 4 supergravity theory itself, which I'll describe in an on-shell language. So we have two CPT conjugate multiplets. And the first has the positive helicity graviton. It has the gravitino. Has vectors and some ordinary spin 1/2 fermions and some scalars. And these indices are the usual kind of SU4 R indices that everyone should know and I hope love from N equals 4 super Yang-Mills. And we're going to be doing pretty much everything in double copy language, so it's nice to keep in mind how to view this as in the double copy language. So there's this multiplet and, of course, the CPT conjugate. We can view this by taking a tensor product and of a pure Yang-Mills multiplet with an N equals 4 super Yang-Mills multiplet. And so that's also where we see the origin of the SU4 R indices. So the next actor are the curvature squared terms in the action.
But you also have you know, kind of conjugated multiplet with H minus minus, right?
Yes, I said there's this multiplet and then there's the CPT conjugate multiplet. So this gives us the multiplet that I've drawn over here, and this gives you the CPT conjugate. So we have, of course, the Einstein term, and there's curvature squared terms and possibly other terms. And one example of that is the Gauss-Bonnet term, which is a certain combination of Riemann and other tensors. And this one is a topological invariant in D equals 4. Or equivalently, a total derivative in flat space. We actually get zero in the flat background. But outside of four dimensions, it can be non-trivial. Actually, one thing I guess I forgot to mention here in the description of the theory is that we have one basic interaction, which has the usual form that we all know and love from super Yang-Mills, basically in terms of spinner products, this would be for a minus minus plus type configuration. We would have an interaction that's this form times the cyclic permutation. So there's a corresponding term with the angle 2, 3, and the corresponding one with the angle 3, 1. And everything else we can then build up, for example, using a BCFW. So that gives you a complete description of the tree-level amplitudes. So in for our curvature squared terms, there are other terms that one can write down in general dimensions. I won't put down a complete list. These things are non-trivial outside of four dimensions, and it's trivial in four dimensions. So in a certain sense, we're going to be working in dimensional regularization. And so we can think of these things as evanescent. That is, they're effectively of order epsilon to the p, where p is some positive power. And at tree level, if you're just doing the matrix elements, you can ignore these things in four dimensions, but you can imagine as you're going to do one loop, two loop, three loop computations, these things, insertions, can be compensated by poles and epsilon, and so you could end up with finite or even divergent effects. And in fact, way back in the prehistory, Tuft and Veltman found that this is a counterterm at one loop in pure gravity. And much more recently, a group, Byrne, Chung, Chi, Davies, Lance, and Josh Noly, realized that it plays a role in the disconnect between the coefficient of the epsilon of the ultraviolet pole and the coefficient of the log mu squared in gravitational divergence. So there's some indication that these terms can play a role in the ultraviolet behavior of gravity theories. And here we're going to take really the very first baby step in trying to understand how this might have an impact in a supersymmetric gravity. So ultimately, we're interested in supersymmetric generalizations of these kinds of terms, and they've been known for a long time for n equals 1 supergravity. That goes back to the work of Ferrara and collaborators in the late 1980s. It's been done in a very sophisticated n equals 2 superspace for n equals 2 supergravity. Much more recently, and for n equals 4, it's not known if there is an off-shell manifestly supersymmetric form. And in fact, there's some suspicion that you can't construct such a thing off-shell in a manifestly supersymmetric form. So we're, of course, working in an amplitudes approach. So we're really basically interested in the on-shell matrix elements. And what we're going to do is to start by doing some computations and use external states outside of four dimensions in order to fully probe the object that we get. Before we do that, we should look a little bit at the symmetries, the full set of symmetries in, that's kind of our last actor. And I want to give you just a very brief poor man's description of these symmetries. So we have the R symmetry, but it turns out that there's another symmetry at tree level. And if we consider a doublet that's made up out of the field stream, so again, these are the SU4 R indices, and we take the dual, then sending this to a transformation of itself almost gives a symmetry, an on-shell symmetry of the action. They're missing terms which are proportional to the scalar field. That's so long as this matrix is an element of SL2R, which is to say that the components are real and the determinant is unity. So we can actually fix this up to be a full on-shell symmetry by adding a spurious degree of freedom phi 0. And now we want to take the two scalars, so out of the one multiplet and out of the CPT conjugate multiplet, and package them along with this spurious degree of freedom into a complex doublet. So that's 3 degrees of freedom. If we want a complex doublet, we have to impose still one condition. And the condition that we will impose is that the norm, in a certain sense, is equal to 1. And again, now with this extra degree of freedom put in, and the same transformation now gives us a symmetry. Of course, we don't actually want this extra degree of freedom, so we have to mod it out, and that gives us our original scalars as a non-linearly realized on the resulting group modded out by the extra degree of freedom. And the two scalars here are going to be charged under that U1. So it's been known again since prehistoric times that this U1 symmetry is anomalous, and that goes back to work of Marcus sometime in the mid 1985. What is been realized more recently that in amplitudes language, that means that there are certain amplitudes which you might naively expect to vanish to all orders in perturbation theory, in particular amplitudes that carry an overall charge under this U1 symmetry. And we can write down some examples of them. So let's think about an amplitude with a negative helicity graviton, two positive helicity gravitons, and one scalar, or equivalently, an amplitude with two scalars of the same charge, and for example, two positive helicity gravitons. Naively, you would expect these to vanish to all orders in perturbation theory. And you can also see that at tree level, you should expect them to vanish by looking at the double copy, because this amplitude, we can just peel off the two helicities into the double copy. So here, in fact, I'm going to reverse the order of the two copies going forward. We have an n equals 4 super Yang nil that's a minus minus plus plus, so just an NHV amplitude, so that thing is fine, but we have to take the tensor of that with a minus plus plus plus, and that thing is equal to zero, even at even in ordinary n mils, as long as we're thinking about tree level. So, in fact, that tree level vanishing still holds, but because of the anomaly, then once one goes beyond tree level, these amplitudes no longer vanish, and that's the amplitude level manifestation. And we'll come back to see that the connection at the very end of the talk.
Does this H, it is in terms of field strengths, this F and G object, it's from Young Bales, or?
Yeah, this is from the vector, and then this is a, uh-huh. In general dimensions, it would be a dual, uh-huh. Let's say in five dimensions, it would be a three-form uh-huh. object.
So these are like one loop. Yeah, they're like the all plus amplitude. I mean, they have a similar status to that kind of.
So
in just regular Young Bales.
So in this recent paper by Radu and his collaborators, what they show specifically is that in fact it's very similar to the nature of the single minus or the all plus amplitudes in ordinary Young Bales. Namely, that they vanish at tree level mm-hmm. because they're really the same amplitudes that would emerge in a supersymmetric theory, and there you have the Ward identity that ensures they're vanishing to all orders. But at one loop, that Ward identity doesn't hold in a pure gauge theory, and so you get a contribution. And of course, because it's something that vanished at tree level, that contribution is necessarily finite. You cannot have any ultraviolet or infrared divergences. So it's just a rational function of the spinner product.
So it's a symmetrized or abelianized version of the color ordered all plus amplitude and gauge theory, right?
The dimensions are a little bit different because it's gravitational
energy. Right. So it has
it's symmetrized. Yeah. I don't think I have the formulas in front of me, but maybe Radu remembers them off the top of his head. No.
So is there actually any amplitude that vanishes to all orders? So these ones
don't. Yeah, there are amplitudes that vanish to all orders, and an example of that would be something like a pure graviton amplitude.
Oh yeah, I meant the ones with pi.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Sorry, what was the question? If there is any, so these amplitudes don't vanish at one loop, but is there any amplitude fine which actually vanishes to all orders?
No.
Okay,
so the one last bit of background, which is really more motivation, maybe I should have started with that, and it was already mentioned by this morning, I should say this is the calculation I'm going to describe is recent work with Steve Byrne and two of his graduate students, Alex Edison and Julio Parra Martinez, and Julio is sitting in the audience for Ebert this morning, so I don't need to introduce him again. So n equals 4 supergravity is UV finite. That we heard at three loops, and at four loops, it's divergent, and the divergence has form. Standard factors, and then maybe somewhat less standard factors, especially the second one in parentheses. And then this tau is some some combination of operators that give a certain structure of the matrix element.
So in this case, you can. There is not this issue where the power is not at all.
Well, I don't know. I mean, is this a reasonable number?
I don't know. Is the same number as in front of block u squared here?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Yes. Okay. Is there no stuff that all the stuff diverges is cancelled, so there is no issue with that?
Okay. So the rest of the talk is going to be about taking the first steps to kind of explore the question of, is there any connection between these various actors that I've laid out, the anomaly, the curvature squared terms, and potentially the ultraviolet divergence. The ultraviolet divergence, we're not going to be able to go far enough in loop order to really say, so this is kind of setting up some of the machinery to explore that in some future work.
But he, in this n equal 4 case, it is R to which power? I mean, Riemann and probably as a high power, right? I'm looking at this k to tens, right? So it's like fifth power where of R?
Well, the operators here also have covariant derivatives.
Yeah, okay, yeah. No, but I mean, if I count them, R has two derivatives, right?
It's a four-point amplitude, so it can be R to the five. Some D to something R to the four.
No, but R to the fifth contribute to four-point amplitude, right?
No.
No,
I think
it's got
R is linear in H,
so
it's got
five
H. Yeah, it should be R to the fourth.
It should be derivative.
Derivative is acting on R to the fourth.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. David, does the trace anomaly survive in any false four supergravity? You know, this, which is associated with the coefficient of the Gauss-Bonnet operator.
I don't know the answer to that question either.
You can talk about it later, because it's not.
Does it depend on which n equals 4 field representation you use?
Because
you can use it, an anti-symmetric tensor to represent one of the two scalars there.
Yeah.
And I think that must make a difference.
Yeah.
Does it depend on one and not on the other? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
With the anti-symmetric tensor, there is no
difference. I mean, the reason I asked that question is, of course, you could have evanescent contributions at least.
Right.
Is that what you're coming to? Or?
We're not going to get to even three loops, much less four loops. But, so that's why I'm saying I'm not, unfortunately, going to be able to shed that much light on the interesting questions here.
But who would say it wasn't an issue for subdivergences for this? And then if we're raising this vector of subdivergences due to evanescent operators.
So wait till the end and you see what
is. I don't know. Maybe, since he's thought about a lot of these annex issues, which I haven't, then maybe he will have some comments towards the end. So what we're going to do is to do just today is just a one loop. Four-point calculation, which sounds like a throwback to the 1990s, except for the fact that we're doing it in gravity and we're doing all the external states d-dimensionally. So there are, of course, here both divergences and or potentially divergences and rational terms and log terms and terms were also done by Piotr and Pierre Van Hove. I don't know if Piotr is in the audience, but no, okay. All right. Before he could answer some of my questions, well, all right. And all terms may also have been done by Berg, Berger, and Schlotterer, but there's lots of assembly required, and we haven't tried to do that yet. So I don't know if it's all there, and I don't know, I assume that if it's all there, it agrees with what we got. So we're going to do this in the double copy. Of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills and pure Yang-Mills, as I described earlier. And we start with the full four-point amplitude in super Yang-Mills. And we're going to use a special representation of the amplitude, the BCJ representation, where the this is running over purely over cubic diagrams. So you want to think about starting from a Feynman diagram, right, where you have to split apart the three-point vertices into pairs of cubic with appropriate numerator factor to cancel the propagator that you put in. And each contribution has some symmetry factor. And then there's a kinematic numerator and a color factor. So this isn't color ordered, this is the full thing. And then, of course, there's a set of propagators for each of the cubic graphs. In this case, of course, it's just the 4 points, so there's only one of them, but let me write the general form. So the thing that's nice, both one and two loops, about n equals 4 super Yang-Mills is that we have only boxes at one loop, and in fact, double boxes at two loops. And moreover, these kinematic factors are independent of the loop momentum. It's at three loops you have to work harder because now the kinematic factors start to depend on the loop momentum. And those kinematic factors, one can write in terms of the three-level amplitude. And I've been a little bit sneaky here and pulled the fast one because this is now actually the color ordered amplitude. And as many people probably know, that object is already passing the network. So I'm able to do that in this case. So what the BCJ construction tells you is that if I now want to go from super Yang-Mills to supergravity, I take the color factors and I replace them with kinematic factors from another theory, in this case just ordinary Yang-Mills. And so that lets us do write down the answer for the supergravity amplitude. And then we have still to do some box integrals with the numerator that is coming out of the Yang-Mills, again the numerator in BCJ form. And then we have to add two more terms which come from a cyclically commuted four. So we have the integral, of course, is just the box integral here with some numerator. there's in fact an alternate representation which directly returns as the and the difference between the two representations would cancel in the notation sum. So basically, just substituting amplitudes for turns out, for our purposes, it's actually more convenient to go back and do this this sum. And in order to organize that, then we want to use a set of basis tensors. And these are objects that are built out of the external momenta and the external polarization vector, again, polarization vector here treated n-dimensionally. So the first thing we do is we conform the various products in a total of six of these objects. Of course, we're still using Amstrad momentum conservation, so now we form all multilinear objects, all multilinear polynomials in these objects, these coefficients that are the polynomial in variant S and T. So we have the infinite multilinear objects, and that gives us 43 tensors. Of course, that's if you now start to think about specific polynomials, then the number grows more, and I can bother counting for any given dimension. So the first thing we do is to impose on-shell gauge invariants. Then we get down to 10 independent tensors. But not all of those can actually appear in amplitude because they don't have the right symmetry properties. Symmetry properties under cyclic rotation, cyclic shifts of the external indices, if we want, if you want for to represent a color-ordered amplitude, or under complete permutations, if we want to be thinking about gravity. So we can do one of two things: we either impose cyclic invariants. In fact, it turns out to be not the right thing to just impose it strictly. You want to impose this either transforms with a plus or with a it's anti-symmetric under cyclic permutations, because you can always multiply by some polynomial in S and T that has the same properties. Likewise, the second choice of basis, which is really what I'll focus on here, is to impose crossing symmetry and again we want to either have a plus under all permutations or the what would correspond to the quote anti-symmetric, which is to have it be multiplied by the signature of the permutation under some permutation of the external indices. And then, of course, you can always multiply. Ultimately, you want to construct a crossing invariant amplitude. You can multiply by a polynomial which likewise has the same behavior, and you get something that's overall overall crossing symmetric. And in fact, there are two polynomials of this form, and there's one polynomial of that. And then the other thing that turns out to be convenient to do is to put these bases in a helicity diagonal form, so four-dimensional helicity diagonal form. I guess I'm supposed to avoid the last, at least the lower part of the last board there.
Okay, the counter. It's clearly.
Well, I'm ready to go here. So we get the following set of seven tensors, which I'm not going to write out in terms of epsilons and k's. I'll describe another language where you can give them a compact representation. And there's one tensor, for example, is just the tree tensor. So of course it is non-vanishing on NHV NHV configurations of the external helicities, if we're thinking about pure gravitons, and on all permutations. There's other tensors that I'm labeling by the non-vanishing configuration. So this one, for example, is all plus. And there's two more tensors that are non-vanishing under MHV type configurations, and one can choose them to have a signature plus and signature minus. And finally, there's two tensors that are a little bit exotic, which I'll call E1 and E2. And these things, in fact, vanish for all four-dimensional helicities. So they are evanescent tensors. And they're not zero as formal objects. And you can test the fact that I haven't, you know, that we haven't made some mistake in our computer programming, because you can actually square them. And square them in sum over states, for example. So this is summing over all the states. These are so far, these are just tensors for one side. They're essentially tensors of the Yang-Mills, because we've managed to factor out the n equals 4 tensors. So ultimately, we do want something that's crossing invariant, because we're summing over all permutations, so that's why we're using the crossing invariant. So these are tensors that are in terms of the vector polarizations. When one sums over all states for all external legs, 1, 2, 3, 4, then in fact one finds something that is non-zero. It's in fact a very large sum. As you'd expect from the fact that it vanishes for all of the You can also check explicitly that these things have non-vanishing forms in six dimensions. So I should point out that in principle, there's actually two ways to get evanescent tensors in for a full gravity object. Yeah, let's say if you're thinking about pure graviton quantities, you can either take the product of two incompatible tensors. So, for example, the cross product of a tree and minus plus plus plus, that would vanish for gravitons. Okay. You need to have both the same. Both of the gluons have to be either plus or minus on both sides of the double copy. Or you can take a product of an evanescent tensor with any other tensor. Those are two ways of getting the evanescent term.
Okay, what happened to the other three independent tensors? I had thought that if I multiplied each tensor by a function,
so
they just summed over all permutations, I would still find 10. What am I missing?
What's missing is that some of these tensors, when you do a double cycle, so you exchange S and T and then you exchange it back, you get something that's, for example, a minus sign. So that's not something. So if you were to do those permutation sums, you would end up with this.
Even if I multiply it by a function that has the right symmetry to cancel?
Yes, because that function, when you do a double cyclic permutation, is just going to go back to itself.
They don't faithfully represent the permutation group somehow.
Yeah, they're not things that can arise in either a color-ordered or fully crossing symmetric theory. I mean, I'm not sure there's any kind of physical theory that they could arise, but at least in these two contexts, they can't. So in order to give, and as it turns out, the most compact representation, and so the way you want to do the calculation, the way it's most convenient to do the calculation is to then set up a set of projectors. So, I mean, here it's not so inordinately complicated, but again, one's building the machinery here. You can define an operator. It's basically the sum over states, and sum over states here for all the external particles. And then you can define a matrix that's given by the sum over all states of tensors contracted with conjugate tensors, different tensors I and J in general. This gives you some matrix. If you now define the inverse matrix, then if you compute the inverse matrix, you can define a set of projectors. Conjugate. And you can now extract at the integrand level the unintegrated coefficient of any given tensor simply by contracting the integrand with this projector. So this is now going to be the coefficient of Tj. So what you do is you simply in turn apply each of these projectors to the integrand, and then you have some scalar integrand which you can reduce one loop by standard means of two loops you'd use either piece. So to actually express the tensors and also in the most compact form the final answer, then it turns out to be convenient to introduce linearized field strengths. So this is just, so this is the same index I, there's no summation. And we now want to contract these things in a variety of interesting ways, which we'll just denote by parentheses. So basically, you're contracting them around the cycle. So for example, this combination would just be JFK sigma mu. And similarly, you can contract two of them again, these labels here are just external particle labels. And there are six basic objects that are natural to define. So for example, FST is just F1234 contracted. Similarly, FTU just correspond to that permutation, so S and T. So here would be F1, F4, F2, F3, that corresponds to one of the cyclic permutations, which we have to sum over. And similarly, Fs squared, we just use as a shorthand for F1, F2, and then F3, F4. Of course, everything has to be linear in each of the Fi because it's linear, it's multilinear in the original polarization vectors. So, for example, we can rewrite the tree tensor as just in terms of 3 of the 4 cycles and 3 of the 2 cycles squared. And these other guys have similar expressions. They're all one-line expressions. There's one very critical exception, and that's this tensor over here. So obviously, I have 7 objects. I only have 6 of these natural kinds of contractions. I need one other object, and that object corresponds to the tree tensor that you get from an F-cubed insertion into the Lagrangian. So if you put an F-cubed insertion in a Lagrangian, you compute using that as a tree vertex. There's going to be some 3-point and 4-point Feynman diagrams. You compute a 4-point amplitude. Its coefficient is a certain tensor. So you compute that the amplitude of one insertion of that, and that gives you a certain tensor. Equivalently, in the amplitude language, it comes from adding an all plus and plus complex conjugate 3-point interaction. So in terms of that that object, then all the other tensors, as it turns out, can be written without resort to this particular new tensor that you introduce. The single minus tensor needs that. And then it has other terms, which are of this form, just involving the 4 cycles. So we now have the basis of velocities, and we have each tensor. We can compute its coefficient, and then it turns out that it's simplest to go back and re-express them in terms of these f's, and we can write down the answer with very little, actually no further assembly required. So there's some constant, which is the usual one loop constant involving gamma functions. And from the n equals 4 side, we just have the tree tensor. And on the right-hand side, from the integrals from the pure Yang-Mills factor in the double copy, we get stuff that's proportional to the tree. And of course, it has 1 over epsilon squared in front. That 1 over epsilon, in a certain sense, you know, is fake, because these are infrared divergences, but in gravity you can only get the 1 over epsilon, and the 1 over epsilon squared goes away, because if you set this to the identity, then momentum conservation will cause that numerator to vanish. Then there's some log terms. So there's L1, L2, and L3, which are functions which are various combinations of logarithms, which I'm not really going to talk about anymore, since we're not interested in doing actual graviton scattering. There's a rational term that involves this F cubed term, or equivalently would have come from an H minus plus plus plus, a single minus tensor. And then there's various stuff that involves both rational and log terms in both the four cycles and two cycles squared. So again, L2 and L3 are various combinations of logarithms. What we want to focus on is this oddball term, the thing that involves the f-cubed insertion. And we're in fact in a position to observe three connections. And for that, we make use of two calculations, one by Lance and Johannes Gödel. And this was in 2012.
Maybe.
And also Song He, and I think a different, it is a Y gang, but I think which is just from last year. So again, if we're looking under kind of a tree level, there's the KLT form of the double copy, which gives us the graviton. So if we just take the ordinary tree level amplitudes, going to get that here. And what these authors observe is that in our language here, if we take the tree and we multiply it in the KLT way, convoluted in the KLT way, with the amplitude that comes out of the F-cubed insertion, then we get exactly the gravitational amplitude that would be implied by a curvature squared insertion. So what we find is that we have an insertion of that, we find a contribution that corresponds to a curvature squared term. It has a coefficient that is, of course, rational. It's interesting that it's simple. And the other thing is that it's actually non-zero and finite. So in pure gravity, this thing would already have a 1 over epsilon, so that then at two loops it could contribute to divergences. Here, it's finite, so at two loops, we're still not going to get any divergences. The earliest we could get any divergences would be three loops. Of course, since the three-loop computation has been done, we know that doesn't happen. We have to wait to four loops to see that.
I'm a little confused. Maybe I don't remember my own paper, but I thought we were looking at a phi r squared operator with the dilaton in it, on the right-hand side of that copy.
For pure graph, you won't see the line in this size, you would get the last one.
So at the three-point level, I have three pluses in one copy, and I have one minus on the other copy. Doesn't that make a dilaton?
Yeah, this is a 4-point.
Okay, so it's...
You're right, but it...
I think that R squared is zero now by equation of the function.
But this is a... The scale deformulates the dimension.
Let's say it again.
The scale deformulates the dimension. So this is a general statement.
Yeah. No, this is outside of four dimensions. Okay. The other point, the other connection that we can make.
First connection. So usually, when you go outside of four dimensions, you can come back to four dimensions by dimensions. To a lower spin object.
That's right. I mean, it would depend on which way
like this R squared thing is really kind of a four dimensional perturbation. I think there's a matter energy momentum tensor squared, which is how it can give it. And I'm not sure what happens there. So, I just. Okay.
Okay, so I'm making progress towards my goal.
You stated that, but you predicted that.
The second connection. If we go back and actually look at the expression for this tensor that's emerging from putting in an F cubed insertion into the Lagrangian, then there's some coefficients, which I won't write out, multiplying the all plus. There's actually a coefficient which is simply minus 1 for the single minus tensor. And then there are various more complicated coefficients for the two evanescent tensors. So, in fact, these all vanish on NHV. And so, as no great surprise, you'd expect every contribution that's coming from this object, because it's a tree, finds something that vanishes in all MHV, is necessarily going to be evanescent for anything that's pure gravitons.
It's evanescent, it means that D equals 4?
Yeah, D equals 4, it vanishes.
Yeah.
So the issue is that as you go up in loops, if you start to multiply this by 1 over epsilons, then all of a sudden you can actually get finite or even divergent contributions. So this is something that you have to keep track of as ultimately you go on to higher loops.
Are there any hierarchy vanishing in epsilon? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes. You can get, if you think about it, so there's simple, there's kind of misaligned, from a pure graviton point of view, there's misaligned tensors that will give you 0, but in general outside of 4 dimensions won't. That's generally in the order of epsilon. Or if you take a product, for example, of where both factors have an evanescent tensor, then it's going to be of order epsilon squared, generally speaking.
But I guess the opposite of the real-time tensor is not for that.
I don't know.
So he did ordinary gravity instead of N equals 4,
right,
with formal polarizations. He would see the 1 over epsilon UV divergence from the operator T mu nu squared, I think. Just because some of the, if you went to formal polarizations of the graviton, some of those would look like scalars or
right,
whatever.
Right.
But here he built because of the N equals 4. Or is there a 1 over epsilon UV?
I think that, I mean,
in this formula?
No. If you had started out with a double copy of 2 manuals, right, then of course all your integrands would have been much more complicated.
Right.
And moreover, you couldn't use this set of tensors to do the projection. Now we're doing the complete set of the tensor products,
yeah,
of these guys.
And just saying, you don't have a 1 over epsilon UV.
There's no 1 over epsilon UV.
Okay, so somehow this UV square is just removed because of supersymmetry somehow.
That would be the guess. Yeah.
But this Gauss-Bonnet does contain 1 over epsilon in one loop, right?
It doesn't contain, it gets multiplied by 1 over epsilon in pure gravity.
Yeah.
Not here.
Not here.
No. So here it gets something that's, it gets a coefficient that's finite.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that in two loops it cannot contribute to 1 over epsilon.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, because I cheated by looking up Sneed's old paper, then we already know that even in three loops, there's no 1 over epsilon. But four loops, there is. And exactly what role this plays in here, I don't know. I promised I wouldn't leave you with any, I'd leave you with more questions.
But in pure gravity, for example, it was 1 over epsilon
yes,
in one loop, right?
Yes. And then, so then at two loops, you can already get a contribution. Okay, so the last connection is to the amplitudes that I mentioned earlier, which were computed by Radu and his collaborators. So, And raise them out again. So this is going to be generated by H3 times. And this coefficient, in fact, because the H single minus only comes from this form, you can just read off the coefficient over there. And the other amplitude is more complicated because it gets generated from various pieces, including including the TF cube, but also gets contributions from elsewhere. But if I had written that out in terms of the helicity diagonal basis, then it would have been just the coefficient of the HL plus. So again, it's the same, essentially the same object that is linked to those anomalous. So this is, it's kind of the beginnings of some connections between these, and of course it's really the two and ultimately three loop calculation to give more insight. The only comment, additional comment that I want to make is that you can see from the structure of the double copy that this term cannot arise once we need to have supersymmetries on both sides of the double copy. So if we're going to go to n equals 5 or higher supergravities, then these tensors will not appear on what's here, the perianual side of the double copy. So that would say that there cannot be anomalous amplitudes in these theories, and you cannot get these kinds of and effects beyond the a great question. I haven't done it, but I have full confidence it must work out the same. It's obviously going to be more obscure.
The answer is in one of the sections of our paper.
I know, but what is going
on? So we have not done the calculation that way, but I'm very confident we will get the same answer, although the path to it would be more obscure. So that suggests this is the right path to take. Did you want to add any comments?
I would just say that we have a better understanding of what is the relevance for this now. And the idea is that, let's talk just now about this R squared idea, would be if we add this as a local counter term, what happens when we go higher loops? If we change our supergravity theory just by adding this, that of course this is going to change, but what happens with the divergences, what happens with the anomaly, etc.
All right, let's walk here. Well, I understand a little better. Is T mu squared renormalized? Does it have a divergence at one loop? It could have a divergence, but it might not have a matrix element on onto the dimensional reduction of these points. You don't see the one of the epsilon. I guess the BBS, although much assembly was required, you could tell whether it had a 1 over epsilon UV or not.
This is an epsilon over epsilon. This theory, with the scalars, so it has a trace in the loop. So you would expect a 1 over epsilon.
Well, there's two kinds of order epsilon. I mean, you take a polarization vector of a graviton to point in another direction, that's not really an epsilon. It's just a state that is viewed as a matter state in four dimensions. And if that can give you a matrix element of the matter of T mu nu squared, and if that T mu nu squared operator is divergent, those are two ifs, then you should see a 1 over epsilon. And you're not seeing it, so one of those two ifs is broken, I think.
No, but if you're working D-, very close to four dimensions, then that extra graviton polarization pointing into the epsilon dimensions is effectively suppressed.
Are we talking? I'm talking about external gravitons.
Yeah. There's still
a different parameter from the epsilon and the loop momentum integration.
Well, if I were to interfere it with some tensor.
Oh, you say that because of this tensor extraction, if you put epsilons in there?
There would be...
because in the way of doing it where you don't do the tensor decomposition, you know, you could just choose some of these indices to point in the phi direction. There wouldn't be any price in epsilon for doing that.
Right.
So maybe something about the tensor decomposition implicitly suppresses those.
No, I don't think so, because you just recover. If you project and multiply by the tensor, you just recover the original form.
So. Okay, so there's no penalty for being.
I'm just thinking. If you actually construct some scalar object, you don't choose a, you don't fix a specific. Excellent polarization.
There is another question, which is if you pick up something in the matrix, you have some matrix element, which is the electron going into two gravitons. That is probably precisely this. And that's where you see the order also, but not in the 4-point amplitude. This is complicated because it's.
It's off in the middle of the 4-point amplitude.
You have a non bunching 3-point matrix element. So complex magnetic, which is graviton going to the electromagnetic field. Okay.
Well, I just think when we were doing that with Clifford, and see that whenever we took these one loop amplitudes and put some polarization vectors in the d dimensions, we were effectively just seeing the feeling this very divergence, although I never sort of check the coefficient of that against any other. But maybe there's something that prevents you from making that correspondence, or maybe it doesn't get renormalized in the n equals 4 case, but I do say he thought it did. Did you say that T mu nu squared is renormalized? It has a divergence?
I thought it is renormalized.
Or it not is renormalized, but is
a
counter term.
It's certainly there in n equals to 2 theories, and in n equals 4, so you should couple, so you would get matter by coupling scalars to the non-square symmetric side, and surely Yang-Mill 4 scalar amplitude, here Yang-Mill's coupled to scalars is divergent. Double coupling that divergence with n equals 4.
Doesn't wash out because of the sum over permutation. Okay.
More questions for David?
If there are no more questions, thanking you.